committee will come to order. We lack a quorum, but I will begin to take testimony. Senator Fisher is here. There are many things going on in the Capitol at this moment, and some of you may not know that Representative McBride passed away today. And I'm sure some senators are preoccupied with that. Stephen Hole has a commitment to be elsewhere and wishes to testify at this time on Senate Bill 400 relating to pupil transportation contracts. The bill would delete language in the existing competitive bid statute that provides that contracts may be awarded by bid or negotiation and may be for a period of 3 years or less. Mr. Hole?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Steve Hole from the department. Department of Education supports the bill, and Mr. Chairman, I'd like to defer to Mr. Botello, who up until very recently was our counsel from the Department of Law.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Bruce Botello. The Department of Law had initially encouraged the Department of Education to seek this legislative change, the reasons being largely the result of litigation some 3 or 4 years ago in the case Transportation Services Incorporated versus State, in which the question was raised about the propriety of contracts exceeding 3 years. The Superior Court held in that case that there was nothing improper about contracts exceeding that period, notwithstanding the language in the statute. Subsequent to that time, an ombudsman's complaint filed against the Department of Education raised this very same question, came to the opposite conclusion. The department seeks this change for two reasons. One, because of this ambiguity, and second, because allowing for contracts over a longer period of time would allow contractors to amortize over that extended period, the ultimate result being hopefully lower costs incurred for pupil transportation.
Well, I suppose the idea is that a offeror could make a proposal and calculate the cost of acquiring the moving equipment and provide for a contract that would cover the life of that equipment.
That's correct.
That's the kind of a contract in some districts that might last for 5 or 10 years could be terribly lucrative. If there is no competitive bid, I could see that the possibility of abuse exists.
Yes, it's clearly there under current regulations of the department. There is a requirement that there be at least three competitive proposals, and in fact, since that language has been incorporated, there have been on every on each contract since at least 1981, three competitive proposals offered. But Mr. Chairman, you are correct. There is the possibility that there would not be that many competitors, and one could very much lock up the contract for an extended period.
Now, is the department the contracting agency for schools, the REAAs, or local districts?
No, each district stands and has a separate contract with its contractor. The state has a separate agreement, reimbursable services agreement, in essence, with school districts.
So this applies to those districts?
Yes.
We have a quorum present for the record to reflect Senator Halpin and I. And we're talking about Senate Bill 400. Senator Halpin, which the administration supports. Do you have anything else?
I have nothing further.
Thank you. Is there further testimony to be offered on Senate Bill 400? This bill has a further referral to finance. Do we have a motion on the bill and move the bill to finance?
Mr. Chairman, I so move.
Senator Fisher moves to report Senate Bill 400. I assume with individual recommendations. Right. Is there objection? Not. Now move to to Senate Bill 542, the microwave bill. This bill was introduced after I went to Clear to take testimony on the microwave exposure incident there, which occurred last September. At that hearing, we were advised that microwave radiation is not addressed in state law. The bill would require that microwave radiation incidents should be reported to the Department of Labor and would include microwave exposure to the concept of the Workers' Right to Know bill that was passed last year. It specifically requires inclusion of microwave exposure safety education programs regarding hazardous and toxic substances in the workplace. It requires information on microwave exposure to be included on posters distributed by the department and requires that employers display the information. It defines microwave exposure level by federal standards and amends workers' compensation presumptions to include microwave exposure incidents. Is Robert Landau here from the Department of Labor?
While the witness comes up, I noticed that some of the written testimony and my suggestions for changes, do you anticipate having a committee substitute drawn to consider?
Yes, I suppose that's most likely. Mr. Landau?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, my name is Robert Landau. I'm Assistant Commissioner for the Department of Labor. And I would like to make a few comments on Senate Bill 542. First, I will say that we have circulated our position paper. I hope by now that the members have gotten a copy of that. If not, we have more copies we can make available. Having had some firsthand familiarity with the events of the Clear microwave radiation incident, I support this bill, and the department and believes that sections 1 through 5 of the bill will enable it to do its job in a better way for two main reasons. First of all, the education and training portion of the bill, which requires employers to conduct education safety programs with respect to microwave radiation hazards, will aid in the prevention of such accidents. Secondly, the reporting requirements that are now extended to cover microwave radiation accidents will assist the department in more promptly learning of these accidents and assuring that prompt corrective action is taken. The department has a couple of minor reservations about some of the language of the bill, and I will briefly point them out. Section 5B of the bill speaks of microwave radiation that exceeds the federal guidelines contained in the federal regulations. The state already has similar, if not identical, guidelines in our Occupational Health and Environmental Control Code, which is incorporated by reference into the State Administrative Code, and we would recommend that the state regulation be inserted in the place of the federal regulation. Secondly, on Section 4 of the bill, which would require employers to display a poster covering microwave radiation hazards and provide an OSHA Form 20, which is also known as a Material Safety Data Sheet, we believe that the second requirement of providing an MSDS would not be feasible because microwave radiation is a physical rather than a chemical agent, and the kind of information that goes in OSHA Form 20 is simply not available to an employer. We believe that the kind of information that an employee needs to know with respect to microwave radiation would be best transmitted through the education safety program that is provided for elsewhere in the bill. In closing, I would also mention that this bill...
Excuse me, just so I'm clear, how would you propose that Section 4 read?
Well, that it would either that it read the same, deleting or to microwave radiation, or that requirement number 2 be deleted with respect to microwave radiation since MSDS sheets don't exist?
It would seem to me that, well, form may not exist. The term equivalent information would appear to point in the direction that the bill would want taken. And if there's some way of providing equivalent information, even though it may not be chemical.
Well, if you look at Section 3 above that, the poster that the Department of Labor is distributing will now contain information on microwave radiation. Section 4 would require the displaying of that poster. My point is that beyond that kind of basic information, there is no information on the breakdown of microwave radiation as there would be with a chemical, for example.
Well, there's another way of doing this, it sounds to me like. If we said on line 2 of page 3, a poster printed by the department under A of this section, and in the case of a toxic or hazardous substance, and then you go on to 2, that would do it.
I think that would solve the problem.
Okay, excuse me, you go on.
The only other thing I wanted to mention is that this bill also would amend the Workers' Compensation Act, and we have with us today Jackie McClintock, the director of the Workers' Compensation Division, and I will ask her to specifically address that aspect of the bill. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jackie McClintock. I'm the director of the Workers' Compensation Division. As you stated, Mr. Chairman, Section 6 of this bill attempts to broaden the workers' compensation rebuttable presumption for employees, presumably in the communications field, by adding the specific language that if an employee sustains an injury consistent with symptoms of exposure to microwave radiation, the injury was the result of that exposure. Existing language in the Workers' Compensation Act already provides coverage for accidental injury or death arising out of in the course of employment and an occupational disease or infection which arises naturally out of the employment or which naturally or unavoidably results from an accidental injury. We feel that if we had a claim of this type, there's no possible way that it would be denied or controverted under the present provisions of the Act.
But, and clear, as I understand it, the employers were controverted in that situation.
No, sir. And I have gone back and I've touched base, and I've had quite a bit of correspondence, copies of which some I've brought along with me to give to you. Those claims were never controverted. They were never denied by the insurer. The problems with the claims went to the payment of medical bills and transportation costs for getting these people to medical facilities, and there's other problems that revolve around that. But they were never denied, and they were never controverted. The problems they had were getting medical reports from the physicians, much of which is in this written correspondence. We even wrote to one of the physicians in Fairbanks, our office, saying, would you please release the information? There seemed to be a lot of problems with the physicians of what type of things constituted this radiation, or what would be the problems that came out of it. They did not submit medical reports. As of April 11th, 84, the insurer said that they were still trying to get medical reports from some of the doctors. But in any event, excuse me, I'm sorry.
I'm trying to remember the testimony that we heard in clear, and as I remember, now that the workers are not necessarily sophisticated about things, but
I have corresponded with about three or four of them myself.
Let me just refer
sure.
to that.
Okay,
some things that aren't specifically germane there, but this is from March 11, 1984, and the questions are basically put by me. Question, are your medical bills being treated, being paid for workers' compensation, or how are they being paid? Answer, well, not great, but I just received another bill from the x-ray department of the hospital just yesterday that hasn't been paid. We're not being taken care of properly at all. When we go somewhere or when they send us somewhere, workman's comp pays for our time off work, but they do not pay for our medical bills. They have never paid to these glasses since this accident. Question, have your eyes changed since the accident? Answer, very much. Question, have you filed to the Workers' Compensation Board? Answer, I sure did. Question, has there been a hearing before the board? Answer, no, there hasn't. Question, is it your statement that some medical bills are paid by the employer and others are ignored? Is that what is going on? Answer, no, I didn't say by the employer. I said by workman's comp, which is, and question, well, that's the employer's carrier. Answer, yeah, the carrier. To my knowledge, they haven't paid any of the medical bills. Question, on what basis have they not paid? Answer, I have no idea. Question, is that your experience also, Mr. Foster? Answer, yes, sir. Even Bob Denham is also a lost wage during the same problem there. Question, well, now, you indicated that the workers' comp pays for your lost wages. Answer, when we are not working, when we were sent down to Brooks, that's the evaluation, the time that I was in the hospital, they paid my time. To my knowledge, they have not paid anything on the doctor bills. Question, Mr. Foster, is that consistent to what your experience is or not? Answer, I'm still receiving this bill. Some of them paid back in December, I can think of off the top of my head. Question, has the employer or the employer's insurance company indicated to you, Mr. Jessop, that this medical treatment we're getting is unnecessary? Answer, well, they have not said that. Question, have they required you to report to doctors of their choice for examination? Answer, I just happen to have a letter here from the insurance carrier. You're welcome to keep that. I will get more of them. I have many copies of that. I am proud of that one. This particular letter is a letter that was sent to me cutting me off from workers' compensation benefits because I refused to go see a rat doctor. And by that I mean a doctor that does study. He is a bioelectrical magnetical engineer and researcher in rats. And I refused to go be examined by him, and consequently I was cut off. I have never to this day received a letter changing that. Question, in this letter from the employer's insurance carrier dated October 24, 1983, you are advised that Mr. Foster had asked that the adjuster locate a physician to evaluate you and Mr. Foster. The adjuster says she works for IT&T Public Services and contacted them, and the only physician they knew of, not affiliated with the Air Force, who received training for radiation treatment was Dr. Gandhi of the University of Utah. Answer, he's a PhD, not an MD. Question, I see. Answer, I don't wish to trust my health with somebody who is not a medical doctor that can say anything they want. She said, I go on. She says she was willing to contact Dr. Gandhi and find out if he would evaluate you and Mr. Foster or review your medical records and advise the carrier that further examination is necessary, and you declined to accept that on the basis that she was an agent for ITT Public Services. Is that correct? Answer, mm-hmm. Question, therefore, quoting, therefore, at this time, I do not see that I can offer any additional services that would be covered under the Workers' Compensation Act at this time. So how many times have you been in Anchorage to see Dr. Sternhagen? Answer, I have been once since the first time. Question, a couple times. Answer, just a week ago, they paid for that trip. They paid for that trip? Yep, they paid for the plane ticket. I was getting the impression that there was no consistent policy here. They were sometimes paying for time off for plane tickets, not for medical care. These fellows didn't know what they were.
Yeah, and I agree with that. And again, the problem goes back to the fact that if they did not receive the medical report substantiating what the billing was or what the billing was for, like I have a couple letters here to Dr. DeRamus on, well, this happens to be on the claim of Ronald Foster, but it goes out throughout Mr. Forsling's claim and there's on Mr. Jessup's claim, and it basically says about the same thing. Please.
Excuse me. Here's the problem. I think what you're saying is that if the medical testimony came back to a carrier saying we can verify that there is a cause and effect relationship between the exposure and the symptom, then the carrier could see that the event occurred would pay that charge.
Excuse me, and they already did pay, of course, the time loss. They had no question as to the cause and the result. What they were asking from the doctors is, would you please give us a copy of your medical report? Because they weren't going to pay for the billings until they knew what the doctors did to them. Dr. DeRamus, evidently, all he sent were the billings. and had never sent copies, he may have now, but as of, this was as of February 13th, had never sent any kind of medical report saying what he had done to these people and what the charges were for. Now, I have also a letter that I wrote to Mr. Foster, and I've contacted him several times, or talked to him several times, and in that, we also discussed one of the main problems is that there's a real lack of knowledge out there on this type of exposure and the type of medical facilities. I had given them one name that I got from the federal government, and I found the person didn't exist, which was kind of interesting. But in any event, I told Mr. Foster that he had stated that he had paid for some of the medical bills himself, and the union had picked up some of the rest of them. In a letter to him of December 20th, and I sent a copy of that and on several letters to the union, saying, if you have paid medical bills yourself or the union has paid medical bills, please get those immediately to Cigna, or LPAC INA, the insurance carrier, along with copies of the reports. I never heard anything further from the union.
But on that. I think the problem is sort of a cognitive problem. That first of all, these gentlemen feel that when they are sent to an airport hospital for evaluation, the prognosis, the diagnosis is particularly guarded as to cause and effect because there is government liability, and that there is a limited amount of expertise on these kinds of events outside of the military. And therefore, physicians are notoriously cautious anyway. Maybe that's in the best sense because they're scientists. But therefore, when you deal with something like microwave zapping and the symptoms may not be immediate. My impression was that you could have three or four people who all had exposure at the same time. And this is what happened in this case. Actually, there's seven or eight people. And the people exposed begin to suffer vision problems within weeks after the event. And none of them has had vision problems during all of their childhood and adult life before the event. And all of them have unusual vision problems because they need prescription changes over and over again within a matter of months. Now, in that situation, some amount of common sense and logic and, I suppose, humanity would say that we ought to assume that the vision loss was due to the event. But the carrier can say, well, I don't have a medical report from an ophthalmologist saying that on the basis of my experience with 100 other medical, 100 other radio and microwave exposure cases, I've seen this kind of phenomenon before, and therefore I'm not able to say as to individual A that there is a cause and effect relationship, and then the same is said in the case of B, and the same is said in the case of C. That is what the section is saying.
But the presumption is already there in the current law. What the insurer is trying to get from the doctors is some kind of narrative report about what they did to the person, what the charges are for. And I don't think this type of thing will do anything to the problems that arose out of this incident. I think the carrier is still going to come back and say, okay, I've been charged $300. What did you do for this $300? I'm not too sure I'm quite sure that this would not really resolve the problems that came out of that radiation exposure and the problems with the insurance case.
Suppose the literature on microwave radiation, I'm doing this hypothetically, but another literature, but the literature says that people exposed to the level that these people were exposed to can be expected to be blind, but the onset of the blindness would not occur until 7 years after exposure. And suppose in 1990, each of these people goes blind. What is their position in 1990 before the board? Are they going to have? Do they have the burden of proof, or does they?
No. The employer still has the burden of proof to show that is still not causally connected to the exposure that happened how many every years before. Under the Act, you have 2 years from your date of knowledge of linking that disability or that problem back to your employment, and it's 2 years from the date of knowledge, not 2 years from retirement. It can be 20 years after your retirement. The same thing that happened in black lung cases and brown lung cases, asbestosis cases. 2 years from the date of your knowledge, you can make that connection. They would still be covered. And the burden is still on the employer to say it did not happen, or to show that it did not happen.
What you're saying is that if Mr. Foster was not symptomatic at all now, and showed up 20 years from now with cancer and blindness and had a good lawyer, he could come to the board and say, I posit that this all happened because I was exposed in 1983 in Alaska. And at that point, there should be coverage for that.
That's right. Still, the presumption is still there, just as, again, for asbestosis or black lung. For many of those types of cases, it's still 2 years from the date of knowledge and the link between your employment and the disability.
Then, what is the objection?
Well, there are several things. I think.
Is it redundant or does it make its policy change?
Yes, sir. Number one, it is redundant. Number two, I guess I can think of two problems that might arise out of this, and I'm not an attorney, so. But I can foresee things happening in this sort. And this may be the extreme. But I can see that if a person comes in that has all the symptoms of radiation exposure, and presumably there may be some of the types of problems that can cause the same type of symptomology. But if that person were never exposed to the radiation and would not be in any kind of job class where he could possibly have been exposed to it, would that mean that his claim would be denied under the general presumption? Number.
Oh. Boy.
If he showed all the symptomology of radiation exposure, but was never in the type of work, that's presuming that there could be some other problems that would show the same type of symptoms. I don't know what those would be, but say there could be. But the person in his line of work would never have the occasion to be exposed to radiation exposure. Would that mean that the general presumption would no longer apply to him? If, in fact, there was some kind of other problem in his work that would have brought upon the same symptoms? And again, I don't know either. That may be extreme, but number two, and I think this is the main thing that we are concerned about, is that I fear that by always trying to or trying to make up special presumptions for special job classes when we already feel that presumption will already cover the person, is that going to weaken the general presumption that's already there for other employees? Presumably the legislation is passed to either fix something that's broke or to provide something that's not already in the act by saying, we're providing this because it's not already in the act, then I think it's possible that it could be.
Like in the case of the firefighters.
Yes, sir.
If it's already in the act, how do you explain the firefighters union and the firefighters members who come here seeking that relief?
Senator, I testified on that several weeks ago, and I have not been able to find a case yet. Your aide, Rex Butler, came down to examine the files that we had in our office. I pulled a computer listing from January 1st, 1982 to current time, and I still can't find a problem with the identifying what they're stating happened to them. I can't find any case. I asked at that hearing that they give me the names of the 10 cases that they said they were denied hearings or they were denied on their case. I still haven't received a response for that. In fact, we started on that 2 years ago. We asked for information for the names of cases where they had been denied by the board, and it never came to us. Quite frankly, I'm wondering if they're not getting the Workers' Comp Board confused with the Retirement Board, because when I went through the files and read some of the correspondence in there, I found where notations to the fact that the Retirement Board had turned them down or had denied them the hearing or something of that sort. I gave copies of that stuff.
Now, the Retirement Board would permit them to retire earlier if it was a job-related
I believe it's on disability. I can't really respond to that because I don't know that much about the retirement portion.
Well, now,
it's job disability, I believe.
Can you tell me whether the, for example, Mr. Jessup's glasses have been paid for? On March 11th, said they've not been paid for.
Okay, let me look at Mr. Jessup's. I have a letter to Mr. About Mr. Foster's glasses. Jessup. Okay, and I will leave these with you. There's a February 13, 1984 letter to Dr. DeRamis from Cassette Benson. And it says, please be advised that our office has received your billings for services dated 9-15, 11-16, 1384 in the amount of $294. At this time, I request that you provide a complete comprehensive narrative report, including your diagnosis and prognosis of Dr. Jessup's present conditions and how it is related to his RF exposure of 9-14-83. Now,
what's that?
Mr. Jessup's present condition and how it is related to his RF exposure of 9-14-83.
Now, that's the problem, isn't it? That the doctor, who was a doctor in Fairfax, who said he'd never seen a case like this involving radiation before, Senator Noss remembers, cannot write back as a professional and say it's my professional judgment that this condition arises from that exposure, can the carrier or will the carrier pay for those glasses in the face of that report?
We've had cases that came before the board, not on this type of thing, but cases that came before, that come before the board, in which the doctor says, I really don't know. I can't say that it didn't happen. I can't say that it's not related. And if there's no presumption or no evidence brought back by the employer to rebut that, the board is going to take that and is going to award that. My understanding from Cigna is that they were trying to get a narrative report. They really don't know what the charges are even for, what's even involved in the charges. And again, legislation that's proposed here still wouldn't fix it because the presumption is already there. I don't think that the insurer is still going to pay a bill just on a billing without any kind of narrative report of what happened and what the expected prognosis, diagnosis. It could be that they won't know, and they'll state that. We have medicals like that all the time.
And then if the government or the carrier brings in a doctor who purports to say that these people all suffered eye visual loss, then the claimants have to go out and find the doctor to rebut that in an area that's pretty obscure, I think, especially in Alaska.
Well, again, I think you'll find throughout the workers' compensation that the claimant's treating physician is certainly given priority. If you have the other doctor says, this couldn't have possibly happened, then there may be a problem, yes. But if he's saying, I don't know, just like the other doctor is saying, I don't know, I think you'll find that the board would find in the claimant's favor. Again, if there was a positive testimony rebuttal from the employer, then yes, there would have to be some other type of medical evidence to overcome that statement.
Mr. Chairman.
Cool.
I'll make a comment, maybe a question. I don't know. It seems to me like, from what I'm hearing here, all the protection is for the companies or for the state or for somebody other than the individual themselves. I think what we're trying to do here is to protect the individual citizen from a hazard that apparently has occurred in microwave radiation. I'm sorry that I missed part of your first part of your testimony there, but it seems to me that we still have got to figure out some way to protect the individual citizen. We know this microwave does give a problem. I know this, it must be dangerous because I've had the thing flashlight bugs. Things in my hand when I inadvertently got involved with the radar system back during Air Corps days. But what we're trying to do here is to protect an individual citizen so that the big companies and the people that's got the insurance and whoever, give that man a better whack at a better chance of getting protected or medical aid or whatever necessary or payment for lost time due to an accident. Does anybody recognize the fact that is microwave radiation something like saying I saw a UFO? This is what worries me.
Senator, I can't respond to some of that. The only one that I am responding to is item 6 on the bill, which deals with the workers' comp provision. And what we're testifying to is that these people are already covered under the general presumption that is already in the act, that if the injury or the illness occurred arising out of and in the course of their employment, then they're going to be covered. The problem that these people had was a lack of medical bills, or the lack of medical testimony, the lack of medical reports, and a medical expertise in this area, which I don't feel that this...
Well, how do they get it? How do they get it? That's the question.
Well,
I saw a UFO. Now, how do I get this from the work? As if we got a doctor who says, I don't know, is his testimony going to be better than one that says... nobody knows, or whatever. You understand where I'm coming from, don't you, Mr. Chair?
Well, yeah, now let me, if I can get in here with this dialogue. When I left the Anchorage Airport this morning, I went to the bookstore and I bought the current issue of Washington Monthly. And the lead article is about workers' compensation. I just scanned it because I was going to copy the Sports Illustrated. And the gist of the article was that state workers' compensation laws need reform because they work very well for the small injury, but the fingernail case, but they don't, and they work very well for the lawyers, they work very well for the doctors and the bureaucracy, but they don't work so well market, the major, the carriers are very good about paying the smaller claims, but the ones they really fight about are the large claims. Now, once there is no controversy as to the injury and the event, let's say now I have been working at Clear and I have exposure to the microwave through an incident like this, and I began to lose my eyesight to a degree, and so I go to the doctor and I, in the course of 4 months, get two different prescriptions because my eyes get worse and I have to wear tinted glasses or something, and I have headaches, and the carrier, under your hypothesis, as long as my information is there, pays my medical bills, and I don't have much time loss. Okay. Refresh me on this because I forget this part of the law. Now, I go along my merry way, and in 10 years, I develop cancer. And now I have a problem of completely different character. At that point, can the employer, through the carrier, contravene the event or controvert the event or the injury and say, even though, I mean, they're not stopped to do so, are they, because they paid for the glasses in 1984, right?
No, that is correct. You can have a controvert immediately, or you can have what they call a midstream controvert or controvert later, in the employee coming back and filing for workers' compensation benefits.
Okay, so then I may be in the position 10 years from then, from the event, as you say, of getting into a cause and effect issue. What you're telling me is that even though I have to do that fine. If there is no evidence on cause and effect, I win. If they marshal no evidence to say this wasn't the result, and my doctors marshal no evidence to say that it was, I should get
that presumption attaches. Yes.
And if they have a scintilla of evidence that says Joe was a smoker from age 25 to 28, which we think is more consistent with his cancer than his mother had cancer, then with the exposure, and I got to get a doctor who says, no, it was the sad thing that occurred in October 1983, correct?
That's correct. But again, I don't, you know, I can't say that this portion that is added is going to do away with that. You know, what we've done here, and going back to some of the discussion by Senator Moss, is that we've written quite a few letters, and I will leave these letters with you, with the chair, trying to help in resolving some of the problems. In fact, we've written letters to the physicians, and it's not really with the prognosis, diagnosis. They're not even putting in any kind of narrative report at all about what they did to the person. In fact, we wrote to a local clinic there in Fairbanks. But in any event, I have written to at least two or three people saying, and the saying that if these bills have not been paid, they have but to file for a hearing before the Workers' Compensation Board, and we will immediately set it for a pre-hearing and for a hearing. There's not been one application for hearing. There's not been any kind of request for hearing before.
Okay. Thank you very much.
One more question, if I may, Mr. Chairman. Okay, the asbestos deal we know is a bad deal. It took many years to get it started, but it started out with just stuff like this. Now, what I guess I'm saying is we should make these amendments to this statute. Is any thought in your mind why we shouldn't do this? Because maybe we got to make a step. This is the first step.
Well, I think, Senator, that if there is a problem, or I think that if going through the files and going through the procedure with these people, if it showed that there's going to be a problem, then yes, very definitely, maybe legislation is required. However, at this point, we're saying we haven't encountered any problem other than problems in getting some of the medical testimony into the insurers. If anything, just as in the firefighters and the policemen, if there is a problem, then we should look at it and we should study it and then go for legislation. But as I explained earlier, the problem in passing a lot of special presumptions, I'm quite frankly afraid that that's going to weaken the general presumption, which is the broadest, probably one of the broadest in the United States today, the Alaska presumption law.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are there other folks who'd like to testify on this? I see and hear no one else. I think it would be my suggestion that we have a CS drawn and that the changes recommended by the Department of Labor, but hold in abeyance the issue of what they're doing with our exception 6. require the Department of Health and Social Services to establish guidelines on what constitutes child abuse and neglect, and the guidelines are available, would be available for those required to report suspected cases of child abuse and neglect. There's backup in your folder from Senator Petula, who is the prime sponsor of the bill. And we have testimony from Gail Boreski and
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Gail Horetsky from the Department of Law Criminal Division. I'm here to talk to you just briefly about Senate Bill 445 and then answer any questions if there are any. As you are all aware, I'm sure, existing law, AS 4717010 and following sections, does require certain named professionals to report to the Division of Family and Youth Services of the Department of Health and Social Services if they have, quote, cause to believe, unquote, that a child has suffered harm as a result of abuse and neglect. The statute lists who's required to report, who they're required to report to. It does set forward the guidelines regarding investigations once a report is received. There's an immunity provision for people who report in good faith, and there are definitions as to what constitutes child abuse, neglect, who's covered under the statute, etc. What this bill would do, Senate Bill 445, would add a new subsection D to existing law, AS 4717020, to require that the Department of Health and Social Services establish by regulation guidelines as to what constitutes sufficient cause to believe that a child has suffered harm as a result of abuse or neglect. That language, cause to believe, is in existing law. What this would require is, as I said, guidelines as to what a person would look at to make that determination. As I understand it, there are some guidelines in existing federal provisions that talk about certain kind of bruising, certain kind of behavioral changes in a child, some statements by the child that would give rise to a professional person of reason to believe that harm has occurred, and that the Division of Family and Youth Services, if this bill were to pass, would intend to look at that federal, existing federal legislation and any other similar state provisions and adopt regulations putting those guidelines into existing law. I think that the advantage to this would be twofold. One is that it would make sure that there was a uniform policy statewide within the division itself as to when a social worker would think a certain report required action by way of investigation. Perhaps more importantly, if the regulations were widely distributed to health professionals, teachers, school nurses, people of that sort, it might be of some assistance to these individuals who are not members of the state agency to let them know what kind of things they're required to report. There is, under existing law, a criminal penalty for a person who fails to report when he or she is required to the extent that there's some question as to would a reasonable person have thought that child was abused. Any clarification in the area, I'm sure, would be of help both to get people to report and also so that they don't feel like they're obeying or disobeying the law at their own peril without any guidelines. Be glad to answer any questions if there are.
Does the department need this to have to issue regulations?
No, sir.
But to do this on its own?
Yes.
I would think that without guidelines, you'd have a hard time prosecuting somebody for failure to report if they said, well, you know, it's a judgment call, and I made the judgment that I have no guidelines to gauge whether this was a case of sexual abuse or not.
Mr. Chairman, the guidelines as they're set forward here that would be adopted would not be included in the criminal law, so we'd have to show the requisite culpable mental state, etc.
No, I understand that, but you could use those as a measure of the person's culpability.
Yes, sir, especially if you could show that he or she was aware of them or if they'd been distributed at a staff meeting or something of that sort. Just for whatever it's worth, and I don't know that this is directly on point, there have been some questions in the past where exactly that situation has arisen, where a case would be presented to the grand jury and a person would say,